call the meeting to order.
We don't quite have a quorum yet, so we'll wait to take any official business, but we'd like to start on time. Is Director Gray, I'm going to butcher this, Hubinger available? So, Director, if you could begin your testimony and basically state your name and your title and who you represent, and look forward to your beginning.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'm Greg Hubinger with the Legislative Coordinating Commission and the Subcommittee on Employee Relations. The Legislative Coordinating Commission is a joint House Senate committee made up of the leadership from both bodies. It has 12 members. The LCC, in turn, establishes a Subcommittee on Employee Relations, which has 10 members, 5 from the House and 5 from the Senate. And that subcommittee is responsible for reviewing and approving labor contracts and compensation plans between the state and its employees. I've been asked to do a brief background piece on collective bargaining for state employees for you, mostly as a warm-up for Representative Knobloch's bill, which you'll be hearing tomorrow, I believe.
Well, thank you. If I can interrupt, and I believe this is really going to help us all get a better understanding of how this process works, but I'm going to call the meeting to order now. And as we do have a quorum, could I have someone do the minutes?
So move, February 19th.
Thank you, Representative Detmer. And all those in favor of the minutes, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Motion passes. Director, if you could please enlighten us on this process, I think it'll help us all.
Mr. Chair and members, so public sector collective bargaining is defined in Chapter 179A in the statutes. It's also affectionately known as the Public Employment Labor Relations Act. This process is used for all public employees in Minnesota, not only for the state of Minnesota, including the courts and MNSCU, but also for local governments, for cities and counties and school districts. This statute lays out the process for bargaining those contracts and the process by which employees negotiate with their employers for their terms and conditions of employment. For this morning, I'll be focusing on state employee bargaining. State agencies, as you know, employ about 47,000 employees. That includes the faculty and staff at MNSCU. I believe you have two pages for handouts in your packet. The first is a chart that shows all of the bargaining units in Minnesota for state employees. There are 17 of them. They're occupationally based by profession. So there's a unit for administrative and clerical staff, for law enforcement, which includes the state troopers and conservation officers, for engineers and nurses and correctional guards, and then there are 3 faculty units for the faculty at MNSCU. The state of Minnesota is considered a single employer. It employs all 47,000 as a single employer. And so an employee who works at a nurse that works at a facility in Wilmer will be paid the same as a nurse who works at a facility in Anoka or in St. Paul, all other things being equal. Each of these 17 bargaining units is represented by a union. Usually one union represents one bargaining unit. AFSCME Council 5 happens to represent 5. So we have 10 unions and 17 bargaining units. 90% of state employees of these 47,000 are represented by one of these 10 unions. There's another 10% who are not represented by a union. Those employees have their terms and conditions of employment determined through compensation plans, mostly prepared and developed by Minnesota Management and Budget. But MNSCU has one for their managers. There are other plans as well for the Office of Higher Education, the State Board of Investment, the Legislative Auditor, and there's a small one for the managers at MNSURE. Those employees do not bargain. Those plans are just determined by their employers. So the state of Minnesota in this bargaining process is represented by Minnesota Management and Budget, and they represent the perspective of state agencies and the administration in the bargaining process, and they negotiate with each of these 10 unions. The labor contracts follow the biennium generally, even though they're not required to in law. So a contract Contracts are in effect now for the FY14-15 biennium. They're coming to an end this June 30th. The state is in the early stages of beginning the negotiations process with the 10 unions for the next round of contracts that would take effect on July 1st of this year for the next two-year period. If you look at the chart, you'll see on the far right that there are some employee units that are designated as being essential. These are defined specifically in PARA to be essential. These employees do not have the right to strike. If they reach an impasse in their bargaining, the issues at impasse are referred to an arbitrator that is on a list that's determined by the Bureau of Mediation Services. That arbitrator comes in, conducts a hearing, makes determinations, and finalizes the contract. That contract, even though it's been arbitrated, has to be reviewed and approved by the legislature, unlike for those of you who have experience in local governments where arbitration awards simply go into effect.
Director, if I may ask a question as we go here. Now, I see that the difference between essential and non-essential, that's a pretty broad statement that these, are there some employees in some of these bargaining units that would be essential, but the overall they're not considered essential? I'm thinking of like state arson investigators, those types of folks. Are they just grouped like that, or are there some that are separated out of there?
Mr. Chair, that's a specific example that I'm not sure what unit they're in. Ms. Cordes might know. I have some lifelines here from MMB and Minsky, but I'm not sure if they are in the law enforcement unit as in the BCA, or if they are professional employees. If they were professional employees, they'd be represented by the Minnesota Association of Professional Employees, and they would not be essential.
There isn't any separation from. So if the whole bargaining unit is either essential or non-essential, there's not separate categories within the bargaining unit that could be essential?
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
Okay, thank you.
As I said at the outset, the state is in the early stages of bargaining contracts for the 16-17 biennium. Representative Knobloch is coming tomorrow with a bill to ratify contracts. These are the tail end of the contracts for the current biennium, for the 14-15 biennium, of which there are 3 months left. There are, I believe, six contracts and plans in that bill. Back to the bargaining process.
Representative Runbeck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On that point, Mr. Hubinger, so that sounds like a considerably delayed contract. That was with Minsky, was it? And if so, could you just define some of the areas where there was contention, or what dragged it out so long?
Director.
Mr. Chair and Representative Runbeck, two of the contracts with the nurses and the engineers that are in Representative Knobloch's bill went to arbitration, and that's a fairly extensive process that takes several months. And so that process alone delayed the finalizing of that contract so that it wasn't able to be ratified by the 14 legislature. Just the culture of the negotiations process between Minsky and their faculty is such that it generally takes a longer time, and they're not able to be completed in time to be considered by the legislature in the first year of the biennium.
And Mr. Chair and Mr. Hubinger, is it possible to, you know, get more of the detail of, you know, the substance of the back and forth, and what they were holding out for, and what was finally agreed to? Can we learn that?
Director.
Mr. Chair and Representative Runbeck, typically what happens in the final stages of negotiations is that the parties bring in a mediator from the Bureau of Mediation Services. And those negotiation sessions are done in closed settings, and those positions generally are not made public. We only know the outcome of those decisions and the negotiations.
Well, Mr. Chair and Mr. Hubinger, I mean, some of those decisions are, terms of the working conditions and so on. And seems like that would be substance that the legislature should be able to discover. Is that, I mean, can we hope for learning that or having any access to the information?
Correct.
Mr. Chen, Representative Runbeck, from what I understand, the range of issues that are on the table are quite wide at the beginning of the negotiations process and get narrower as they get close to closure. We could certainly inquire about what the issues were that were on the table, but generally that has not been made available.
Mr. Chair, and I mean, it's, gosh, everything else around here is public data. I'm really surprised. I did not know that. So I think it seems like it would be worthy of pursuit to me. Thank you.
Sure.
Thank you. Representative Pugh. Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, my concern is that here we have just 3 months left in the biennium, and we are going to be presented the contracts, which have already, you know, gone for this extent. And I'm wondering if at any point in the history of our state with regard to negotiating these contracts, if they've ever been solidified before the next biennium, so that we can, as a legislature, consider what the ramifications are of those contracts in our budgeting process.
Director.
Mr. Chen, Representative Pugh, there have been a handful of occasions in the last 15 years where some of the contracts have been actually ratified. It would be in this session for the 16-17, but it's been very rare. Largely because the unions and Minnesota Management Budget need to understand what the appropriations are so they know what the resources are that are available for discussions in talking about wages and benefits.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Continue, Director.
So the MMB is in the process of negotiation. They're negotiating their contracts with the unions now. They typically focus on the two larger unions, AFSCME and MAPE, but that's not required. But those contracts tend to get settled first. The goal is generally to try to get that at least negotiated by the end of the contract so that they know beginning July 1 what their terms and conditions of employment are. It takes a while for the unions to get the contracts ratified. They are then submitted to the LCC Subcommittee on Employee Relations, which meets at the call of the chair when contracts have been submitted. That 10-member group, 5 members of the House, 5 members of the Senate, typically a 3-2 split for the majority and minority caucuses, will review those contracts. They have the ability, the authority, and law to provide interim approval so that those contracts go into effect. Subcommittee has the authority to reject a contract, in which case the parties would go back to the table and continue bargaining. All contracts have to be submitted to the next session of the legislature for ratification. If the legislature does not pass a bill ratifying the contracts are voided. The changes or increases in benefits and salaries cease to be paid. Employees are not required to pay back the increases in benefits and wages that they received during that interim period. At that point, the parties again would have to go back to the table and negotiate new contracts.
Director, could you indicate to us which out of the 17 bargaining units, which ones are represented by AFSCME Council 5?
Mr. Chair, the first row indicates AFSCME. And I've sort of clumped all of the bargaining units that they represent in that column. It includes the clerical and administrative staff, technical, healthcare, non-professionals, the correctional guards, which is the essential employee unit, and craft and service employee units.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, that's a quick overview of the process itself. I was going to take a couple of minutes and go through the settlement sheet. It's a costing sheet that the subcommittee uses for tracking the costs of collective bargainings. You'll see this again tomorrow, but it might be helpful to walk through it now so you might be familiar with it.
I think that would be most beneficial. Go ahead.
Mr. Chair and members, so the second page of the handouts that we provided is a settlement sheet that the subcommittee uses for tracking costs of contracts. This is the settlement sheet for the current biennium for the 14-15. Representative Nawat's bill would ratify six of these, and they show up in bold on the on your chart. But all ten unions, and then the five compensation plans for unrepresented employees are shown on the left. The next four columns show the across-the-board increases that employees will be receiving under these contracts. And these are the numbers that tend to get talked about most around these halls and in the media about what the across-the-boards are. They are increases that are received by all employees who are on the payroll at the time. Employees receive this kind of increase and generally one other. The other kind of increase are performance increases or step increases, they're sometimes known as. These are increases that are based on performance, based on a performance review, and vary by contract. The AFSCME contract provides steps that are about 2.75%, and they range up to 4%. An employee has to have a performance review indicating the quality of their work before they receive these. They're eligible for one of these each year. They're also only eligible for these until they reach the maximum of their salary ranges. Once they hit the maximum, they're no longer eligible for these performance-based increases. The state workforce is mature enough that about half of all employees are at the maximum of their ranges, so they do not receive them. And so those employees only receive across-the-board increases. The next two columns show the dollar impact of these contracts on the current biennium. The first column is the biennial base. It's basically a snapshot of all the salary and benefits these employees are receiving just before this contract took effect, these contracts take effect. And so if all employees' benefits and salaries were frozen, the state would be paying in total something like $7.3 billion in compensation for the state workforce. The 14-15 contracts provided some increases in salaries and benefits. That's reflected in the biennial new money column. That includes all cost increases across the boards, the step increases, the impact of those increases on retirement, health insurance increases. The total of that for these contracts and plans is about $330 million in the current biennium. The next column shows that at those increased costs as a percentage. For this biennium, the impact is about 4.5%. The contracts and the benefits in those contracts go into place or into play over the term of these 2 years of the contract, and so not all of the increases are paid for the entire biennium. Employees receive their step increases on their anniversary dates, for example, and so you only pay them for part of the biennium. The impact then, though, is on the next biennium, on the 16-17 biennium, when you pay that those increases for the entire two-year period. And so the subcommittee tracks the cost of impacts on the next biennium as well. So the second to the last column shows what that percentage impact is of these contracts on the next biennium. And so in total, these contracts, these 14-15 contracts, will have an impact of about 6.6% on the 16-17 biennium. And that's at a total cost of about $486 million.
Thank you, Director. Now, on these contracts that we're just going to be voting on or hearing about tomorrow, are those then paid retroactively, or are they current? How does that work? Is it retroactive? Are they going to start that in the next biennium? How do these contracts that we're just going to look at tomorrow affect these numbers?
Mr. Chair, the contracts that you'll see tomorrow were given interim approval by the subcommittee during the last interim and went into effect then. All of the contracts that have been given interim approval are retroactive to July 1, 2013. So they've been receiving these increases for the entire period of the biennium.
So then why did it go to arbitration, Director?
Mr. Chair, for the nurses' contract and the engineers' contract, there were issues regarding wages and some ancillary benefits that they couldn't agree on. And they went to arbitration, and as a result, there was a contract that became finalized that was approved by the, given interim approval by the subcommittee and implemented.
So what would have happened if those subsequent increases wouldn't have gone into, they wouldn't have been approved by the arbitrator, it would have went the other way? How do they reconcile the interim agreement from the what the arbitrator decides? Do they recoup those dollars then, or how does that work?
Mr. Chair, the employees in those two bargaining units were being paid under the terms of their prior contract until the new contract went through arbitration. There was a new contract negotiated and then given interim approval by the subcommittee. Once that subcommittee gave interim approval, the increases that were negotiated were granted and effective retroactively to July 1 of 2013.
So then there was some lump sum payments made to catch people up?
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
Thank you. Any other questions? Everybody got, has a good understanding? Oh, Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The last biennium, there was a minimum wage increase passed. And my first question would go to, what effect would that have on existing contracts or contracts going forward as a baseline?
Director.
Mr. Chair and Representative Albright, I believe that there are no state employees whose wage rates are affected by the minimum wage.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Albright.
Thank you. Do you know what the projected GDP of the state going forward for the next biennium is expected to be?
Director.
Mr. Chair, I do not.
Just for your information, in 2013 it was 2.8%. Mr. Chair? Director, what would be your estimation in terms of the median household income growth or decline during the same period of time?
Mr. Chair and Representative Albright, I don't have that information.
Okay. Representative Albright?
Mr. Chair, during the same period of time, it declined precipitously from what we see on this piece of paper. Mr. Chair? Director, I note on the graph before us that there seems to be a consistency to the amount of increases both in 2013 and 2014, with one anomaly, which is at the bottom, which is the Office of Legislative Auditor. I wonder if you could explain that.
Director?
Mr. Chen, Representative Albright, the salary plan that is managed by the Legislative Auditor has a built-in clause that provides for 4% salary increases for staff covered by that plan. And so although the across-the-board increases for that plan were 2%, 1.5%, and 1%, the auditor has the authority to grant up to 4% increases to his staff.
Representative Albright?
Mr. Chair, thank you. Director, I think it would be beneficial in light of the state GDP and the CPI, as well as the median household income of the citizens, if we could be provided with that array in comparison to the amount of increases that we are projecting and observing on this piece of paper, so that we can understand or appreciate the broad spectrum of people who generate income in the state through their wages and salaries.
Thank you, Director. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning, Mr. Director. Looking at your page with the employee relations, I'm seeing three open lines here: the personnel plan, the OLA, and the MNSURE compensation plan. Can you tell us why that there's no figures in these columns?
Director.
Mr. Chen, Representative Anderson, those plans have built-in authority for employees to receive increases. And so, for example, the MNSURE plan has existing authority for the director to grant performance-based increases of 3% each year. The plan was last submitted to the legislature in 2013, and so it has not had to be reviewed since then. But there are performance-based increases which don't show on this chart. We only show across-the-board increases.
Representative Anderson? No, thank you. Representative Runbeck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So looking at the unrepresented state employees, so the 1,300 managers, then, how are their wages determined if they're not represented by a union?
Director.
Mr. Chen, Representative Runbeck, there is a compensation plan called the managerial plan that MMB develops and submits to the Subcommittee on Employee Relations, and that plan provides specific provisions for both performance-based increases and across-the-board increases for their managers. That plan was submitted in time to be reviewed and approved by the 2014 legislature.
Okay.
Representative Runbeck.
And Mr. Chair and Mr. Hubinger, does then, so MMB is involved in that negotiation process? Is there a negotiation or not really, I guess?
Correct.
And basically my question is about the sort of the responsibilities, the expectations of performance and so on. Is that something that is by fiat, you know, you do this or you lose your job, or what protections do they have, I guess?
Director.
Mr. Chen, Representative Runbeck, the managerial plan has fairly specific language describing the conditions under which managers are eligible to receive increases and describing and requiring performance evaluations to be conducted before the managers can receive them. It isn't, as you point out, a negotiations per se, because the department simply establishes the plan. The statute recognizes that difference and gives the Subcommittee on Employee Relations the authority to modify the plan if it believes that there is some deficiency.
And Mr. Chair, Mr. Hubinger, what percent of these, would you consider most of these, or what percent are political appointees?
Correct.
Mr. Chen, Representative Runbeck, there are 1,300 employees. I believe typically it's the assistant and deputy commissioners that are considered to be political. And there are somewhere in the range of 65, 75 of those positions in the 26 larger state agencies.
Representative Runbeck.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Hubinger, the managers, though, they are at-will employees, are they not?
Director.
Mr. Chen, Representative Runbeck, that isn't entirely the case. There is a portion of those 1,300 employees that are classified, and so they could only be terminated for cause.
Okay.
Representative
Runbeck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Earhart.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm wondering, Mr. Hubinger, if we could get the family income increases in the fourth tax bracket as well, as long as we're comparing various and sundry. Suppose that's possible.
Director.
Mr. Chair, we can look into that, yes.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Hubinger, could you give me some context on employee increases? I would expect, and I haven't reviewed this, but over the last 10 years when economic times weren't so good, what were the kind of increases or non-increases, I guess, that state employees had during that period? So just get some kind of history of little or no increases during the times when things were difficult for the state budget.
Director, do you have that information?
Mr. Chair and Representative Johnson, the during the period around the recession, starting in fiscal years 10, 11, and 12, and 13, employees received, there was a period of 4 years there where there was only one across-the-board increase of 2%. Most employees continue to receive their step increases, but that was the only increase that they received, and that was only for the half of state employees that were not at the top of their salary ranges. So during the during the recession, shortly after, there was a marked limitation on salaries for state employees.
So, Director, they continued to get their step increases. They just didn't get any cost of living increases.
Mr. Chair, that's correct. There was 1 year in fiscal year 10, I'm sorry, when they received neither steps nor cost of living.
So when they, after that time, did they get two steps then because they had more time in, or how did that work then? How did they reconcile that that missing a step?
Mr. Chair, they did not double up on steps. They continued to receive the one step per year that they're eligible for.
Thank you.
I think, Mr. Rod, I guess the point is that our hardworking state employees have really had to take a hit during the tough years, and I think we need to acknowledge that. And with respect to step increases, I think it's probably only half of the employees that had that. Is that correct?
Correct.
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, that's correct.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If we really want to look at the CPI or inflation adjustment and cost of living adjustment, do you know what the burden was for increases in their health insurance costs? So the medical inflation is tends to be much higher than the CPI. And if we really want an accurate picture of these increases in their wages through these contracts, what's the true impact in terms of their total compensation as healthcare costs go up?
Director.
Mr. Chair and Representative, we track the increases in health insurance premiums. I don't have that data with me. It varies significantly and seems to be independent of inflation. It depends on the experience. The state is self-insured, and so it depends on claims actually filed by employees and also affected by inflationary costs. I'd be glad to get that to you.
Thank you.
And those costs are the same, generally speaking, through the private sector as well as the public sector, would it not be, Director?
Mr. Chair, the state has a single insurance plan that it provides to 140,000 lives, so it's a fairly significant pool. I don't have a good sense about how those premiums compare to other large organizations' health plans.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, it really varies across employer groups. So, you know, based on my experience, you see a variety of costs shifting onto employees when costs go up. So they have higher out-of-pocket payments, higher deductibles. So it really does vary. And I don't know the experience of the state plan, but if you can provide that information, that would be great.
Thank you. Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Director, at the bottom of this diagram, your notations number 2 and number 4, I'm just wondering if you could elaborate on point number 2. It says percent of new money needed over base, excuse me. Is that pursuant to contract negotiations that are underway or consummated?
Okay. Correct. Mr. Chair and Representative Albrecht, that percentage reflects the increased costs of the contracts for the current biennium, 14-15, over the base for this biennium.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Albrecht.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Director, your point number 4, it says, this may have been touched on earlier, groups within plan follow lead of comparable bargaining units. And I'm just trying to ascertain from the notation number 4 which groups that pertains to.
Director?
Mr. Chair, Representative Albrecht, The commission's plan is sort of a miscellaneous group. It includes confidential employees. It also includes employees that have severed from their bargaining units. And so the benefits and salary increases for those folks follow the increases that were in the contract that they were severed from. So confidential administrative clerical staff in that plan would receive similar increases to the AFSCME administrative clerical contract.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When these bargaining units are in negotiations, what all is part of the contract in terms of the partitions, in terms of salary, incentives, their health care, their sick pay? Can you give me not a laundry list, but the identifiers in terms of what is included in the contract negotiation itself?
Director.
Mr. Chen, Representative Albrecht, the entire contract is up for negotiation, and so it includes every provision that's in the contract. In real terms, these contracts are relatively mature, and so 90% of the terms are probably pretty well established and are left alone, and so the focus is on benefits and issues that have come up during the previous 2 years that they need to address to meet needs of the either the employees or the employer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess my question, part of my question was asked by Representative Schultz regarding the total package increase and how the health insurance cost of health insurance costs rise when they go up. How does that affect employees? So, like, in the years that there were zero increases and the health insurance costs went up, how does that affect the employees' wages?
Mr. Chen, Representative Nelson, so the state pays for, it now pays for 95% of the premium for the employee and pays for 85% of the premium for dependents. And so as the premiums go up, the employees shoulder that share of the increase. There have also been negotiations in terms of the co-pays and deductibles, and those have been increasing over time as well.
Representative.
So, Mr. Chair, so I guess the point I'm making here is that when we have freezes or even when we have a 3% increase, when they get a raise, that the costs that they have to pay out of pocket go up, they in effect are not making more money. And if in years that we've had zero increases, they in effect are making less money because they're having to pay more of the shoulder more of the cost of that insurance, those insurance costs that they were paid for before. So they're actually getting a cut in pay when we freeze them and then raise their health care costs or their out of pocket costs.
Thank you. Representative Detmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And maybe just some clarification, Director, you mentioned that the Subcommittee on Employee Relations already approved these raises, and they're being paid these raises. Am I correct on that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Depper, that's correct.
Okay. Mr. Chair and Mr. Director, now, I'm assuming that the legislature has to approve these then, and what would happen if, to say, the legislature didn't approve the raises?
Directors.
Mr. Chin, Representative Detmer. So Representative Knobloch's bill that you'll hear tomorrow would ratify the remaining six contracts and plans for this biennium. If the legislature failed to pass that bill, those contracts would be voided. The increases and benefit changes and terms and conditions that were changed in those contracts would cease to be implemented, and the prior contract would be reinstated.
Mr. Chair, and then just a information. Okay, so they've already been paid. Would they have to pay back to the state the money that the increases that they've had?
Director.
Mr. Chen, Representative Depper, no, they do not have to repay the amounts that they've already received.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Representative Carlson.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, part of what I was going to ask about has been covered, but when we talk about the cost of health care, and this isn't where I'm going now. I've got another question, but we also have to keep in mind is that often the co-pays were increased as well. That may have varied depending on which contract, but if we look back over time, that was another cost that employees had to cover each time they go to the doctor or to a hospital. But I did want to ask, you referenced the number of employees that are at the top of their salary schedule and would no longer receive a step, and so I assume that many of those are close to retirement. And when I'm looking at the bottom line numbers here where you deal with the cost of the contract, and the reason I'm asking this particular question, years ago I carried some legislation on early retirement, and there were savings when people were encouraged to retire. In fact, for the other side of the aisle, one of the bills I had, I worked with Keith Downey on, and then I had another earlier one, but there were savings. Now, we didn't have an early retirement incentive program in place, I don't think, at this point in time. So I'm just basically asking, though, when we look at the cost of the contract, I assume you must build in then the projection about the number of people who maybe are going to retire. And when they're replaced, if they're on a salary schedule with steps, they're usually going to be replaced with somebody that's going to be at the first step, or if they've had some experience, perhaps given some credit for that, but typically wouldn't be replaced at the top of the salary schedule. And is that built into these numbers then? Do you have a projection on likely retirements with history and that kind of thing as to what happens with the state workforce?
Director?
Mr. Chair, Representative Carlson, both MMB and Minsky, when they're calculating the cost of these contracts, take into account turnover savings. So they capture the factor of replacing a more senior faculty who retires with a new employee at a lower salary, but then, as you point out, the need to start paying the step increases that this new employee is eligible for. That's not broken out in the costing numbers that we get from MMB, but I know they factor that into their costing.
Thank you.
Representative Lane.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to make comment. Representative Albright mentioned item number four here. Groups within this plan follow the lead of comparable bargaining units, and I see that the only thing that refers to is the commissioner's plan, and as we know, the commissioners didn't really follow the lead of comparable bargaining units for, a dozen years. If you look at a chart, you see sporadic little bits here and there for some of them, but we have not moved them along as one would expect according to this kind of item here, so that we had heartburn when we tried to catch them up after 12 years, and I remind people that was heartburn, not reality, that actually if they had gotten their movement along the way, they would have been where we wish to have them now. But now that's water under the bridge for a little while here until we clean this up.
Well, to that point, Director, I see that in 13-14 they did get a 3% raise along with the rest of them. Is that abnormal for the history behind that?
Mr. Chair, there's something of a misnomer here. The commissioner's plan doesn't cover commissioners. It's the commissioner of Minnesota Management and Budget's plan for unrepresented employees, and we refer to it as the commissioner's plan. So the 1,300 employees that are covered under that plan are unrepresented employees that are confidentials or have severed from their bargaining units. Agency heads that Representative Lane pointed to are not covered or captured anywhere on this spreadsheet.
Thank you. Representative Pugh.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Mr. Hubinger, I just have one question. It's with regard to the second to last column. And if I'm not mistaken, so that number, the 6.63%, is the impact of this contract that we're going to be hearing tomorrow on the next biennium. Is that correct?
Correct.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pugh, that's correct.
Okay, and so can you help? Thank you, Mr. Chair. Wondering, Mr. Hubinger, if I maybe not connecting the dots properly, but wondering how to square the 1.8% that has been requested by the various agencies with the reality of this number and the impact of the bargaining.
Direct.
See, Mr. Chair and Representative Pugh, in the presentation of these contracts to the subcommittee by MMB and MNSCU, it was understood that the costs of the contracts in this biennium were to be covered by their existing appropriations. There's no appropriations tied to Representative Knobloch's bill. MMB in their budget documents instructed agencies to factor in a 1.8% increase in compensation for the impact of these contracts and or additional increases that might be negotiated in the 16-17 contract. That's as I understand that number.
Representative Pugh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Mr. Hubinger, that the number that was presented to us was the 1.8% by every agency, but it looks to me that the reality here is going to be something very different than that. So I'm really struggling with, you know, really how, you know, here we are hearing all of this and are going to need to put together a budget, but the reality of what it would appear is very different.
Director.
Mr. Chair and Representative Pugh, these numbers, for the $486 million, would be part of the base budgets for all of the agencies. And so they have factored in this cost in what they're presenting to the various appropriations committees.
Representative Pugh.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Representative Lunan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you for testifying today and answering all of these questions. As a freshman, it's been very helpful for me, and some of the questions have been helpful as well. I come from an insurance background, and we talked about the very real factor of out-of-pocket. You know, you take a look at what percentage we're paying for premium, and in every sector, whether it's private or public, that's a reality. The data shows that there's real opportunity in being proactive regarding health. And so my first question deals with that area, is that in some of these contracts, do they ever work in an incentive for the employees from a lifestyle standpoint to do different healthy things to try to keep the cost down, which would in fact ultimately would affect them too because they're paying higher co-pays and out-of-pockets. Is some of that put in their contracts now, do you know?
Director.
Mr. Chair and Representative Lunan. So the state has a self-insured program that applies to all state employees, and it's the same across all contracts and plans. It's also the plan that the legislature participates in that covers staff and members that participate in the plan. Because it's self-insured, there's incentive to try to manage costs as much as possible, and they have an extensive set of wellness programs that they are promoting. It might be helpful at some point to have Minnesota Management and Budget and Insurance Division talk about what those programs are.
Representative Luna.
And are they, is there any data, because they're self-employed, as to how effective what they're promoting is or is not?
Director.
Mr. Chen, Representative Luna. That'd be a good question for MMB, their insurance division.
Representative Luna.
And then final question, this to a different topic now, is we talk about steps, and I come from a background of a school board, and I had longevity steps in their contracts as well, and Representative Johnson has been helpful explaining some of the nuances that are different, but what is the time, how many years would it take if I start as an employee now, how many years would I be here before I max out where I'm topped off on the steps?
Correct.
Mr. Chen, Representative Lunan, the any number of steps varies by each contract. I believe for professional employees it's 12, and for clerical administrative staff it's 7. It varies by each contract.
And if I can interject, Director, does that mean there's an annual increase, or does it vary if I hit if I start at year one, I get my first step in year three, I get my next step at year six? Or does it vary like that, or is it every year you get a step increase, Director?
Mr. Chair, an employee is eligible for a step each year on their anniversary date.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Runbeck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Wanted to just find out if, in the event that there are layoffs within state agencies, is there a 10-year rule in effect that is similar to our school system, so that it's not, you know, performance that's taken into consideration? It is simply the time you've been, you know, in the seat.
Director.
Mr. Chair and Representative Runbeck, the layoff procedures are quite complex, but the general principle would be that the least senior person in the class that, or the position that needs to be laid off, is laid off. There are extensive bumping right provisions so that if a particular position over here is the one that needs to be laid off, the least senior position would, at least senior staff would be the one that ultimately gets laid off.
And then, Director, that one could, if it's a similar position to a position over here in a different, and they could bump from here to there if they're more senior over here, and bump that less junior place if the positions are the same.
Mr. Chair, as a general rule, that would be accurate.
Representative Runbeck, follow up?
Mr. Chair, thank you. So you did mention that there are performance reviews. I don't know if that's annual. You know, is there any situation under which somebody who annually, you know, is underperforming, not producing, not contributing, is able to be laid off by a manager who's really doing their job and sort of watching it and taking care of it?
Director.
Mr. Chen, Representative Runbeck, a supervisor who has conducted performance evaluations and found the employee to be underperforming has the ability to go through the discharge process, yes.
I see. Thank you.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just want to caution everybody with what Representative Collison's question about early retirement incentives that we've had, having served on the Pension Commission. When we do early retirement incentives, yes, it does show a savings on our budget, but it transfers that cost over to the pension plans. And so when we're offering early retirement incentives, that we are basically just shifting that cost over there, and sometimes in the future we end up having to bail those pension plans out because there's a bigger draw on them. I know Representative Kahn is, in the past, has been a was a strong advocate for early retirement, and she's kind of changed a little bit her point of view on that because of the cost shifting that it does to the pension plan. So I just want to put that as a caution so we're not all thinking we can save money in our budget by offering early retirement and getting rid of these higher paid older employees.
Absolutely. Point well taken. Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
That's true.
Commissioner Hubinger, you mentioned in earlier testimony that the state pays 95% of the insurance cost for an employee, which means that's 5% for the employee that they are responsible for. Can you give me an idea, for the sake of the committee, what that 5% represents of the total premium?
You want your speech, your microphone.
Let's see. Mr. Chair, I believe, and Representative Albrecht, I believe that the premium for an employee only is around $7,000. And so it's...
That's the total, Mr. Chair.
Yeah. Representative Albright.
That would be the total premium for the year, the annualized premium for that individual?
Mr. Director. Chair, that's, Representative Albright, that's what I remember.
And Mr. Chair?
Representative Albright.
So then the 5% of the 7,000 is the obligation of the employee?
Mr. Correct. Chair, Representative, that's correct.
So, Mr.
Representative
Chair?
Albright.
Mr. Hubinger, then, so that would be representative of roughly about $400 on an annual basis?
Director.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, yes.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Mr. Director Harbinger, do you have any idea in terms of what the private sector, in terms of the split, is between the employee responsibility and the employer responsibility?
Director.
Mr. Chair and Representative Albrecht, I don't have that data with me. I believe that MMB has some sense of that as they're negotiating those terms with the employee unions.
Representative Albrecht.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just for the sake of the committee, much like Representative Luna, I share an experience in the private insurance business, and I can share from experience that in most cases health insurance is a 50-50 split between the employer and the employee responsibility for the health insurance premiums. And so as we compare and contrast, just to illustrate the differences between the private and the public sector. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Albright. Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I like accurate data on that split. I mean, there's a lot of 80-20 splits, too, but let's talk about that on HHS. So my question is, once they get to this step, and it sounds like some can make it in 7 years or some can make it in 12 years, they're only getting the increase of the cost of living that's negotiated, or this 3% or whatever they negotiate to cover inflation. Is that correct?
Director.
Mr. Chen, Representative Schultz, that's correct.
That's correct.
Representative Schultz.
So there's no other option to do promotion-based or reward-based increases in their compensation, salary?
Director.
Mr. Chair and Representative Schultz, promotions are only available if there's another position to be promoted to. So those opportunities exist, but they're not systemic.
Representative Schultz.
Mr. Chair. So is there a lot of turnover once they hit that plateau? There's no more steps to go up. Is there a lot of turnover?
Director.
Mr. Chair and Representative Schultz, we have, or MMB provides data on overall turnover rates. I don't know if they distinguish between turnovers for rates for employees that have hit the maximum of their ranges versus those that haven't. The pattern seems to be that the state loses the employees earlier, or earlier in their tenure rather than later.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Kahn.
Yes, I just, one of the things that works actually is if the problem with early retirement was that for a city, is that the city saved money and the pension plan paid it. One of the ways you can fix that is to then make sure that the pension plan is being the city is reimbursing the pension plan for some of the money that it saves. So, you know, you can figure it all out.
Right. Thank you for that comment. Representative Carlson?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I wasn't going to comment more on that, but they are correct. I mean, when Downey and I were working on the most recent one, and then I had another bill in the early 90s that was a one-year opportunity for early retirement. That particular one did save school districts, cities, the state on their budgets quite a bit. But yes, there is a cost. That first one, we gave an extra year on the pension plan if they retired early. So clearly there was a cost. However, at the time we did that particular plan, the pension funds were quite healthy. You know, in that sense, we've had
retirement, didn't we?
So, but at any rate, we could go back and forth on that, but I would concur with both Representative Nelson's and Kahn's comments about it does eventually cost the pension plan some funds. I just wanted to comment a little bit, having been an observer for many years of the collective bargaining process. It often boils down to how much money is available to put into the contract. So when we talk about health insurance and what the employee share is and what the salary level may be, if you've got X number of dollars that you're going to put into the contract, eventually the negotiations then settle in on that cost. And then the negotiations are part of, well, how much do you want to spend on health insurance? How much do you want to put into the salary plan? Do you want to add dental insurance? I remember that was a big debate at one point. So my only point is, even within our collective bargaining units looking at state and local governments, sometimes that gets pretty complex when you start comparing contracts, because every contract has its own history. And some may have preferred to put the money into salary, others into various fringe benefit programs. So that's where the difficulty comes in, and I did want to respond to your question about how they compared with the private sector, because you have the same issues there.
Thank you. Representative Earhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I know that in MnDOT, they've had a lot of problems with the ranges of the salaries there, where the top engineers leave because there's no more room to move up, and they go out to private industry and make a lot more money. So that's a tough way. It's hard to retain their top experienced engineers because they're just, you know, the top people over there probably, this a couple of years ago, had only a few dollars between between a number of them, you know, $10 a month or something, just to keep a separation there. And that was time to blow out of there and get to the private industry in which they were doing.
Well, thank you. Well, last final question, because we're running over time here. Was that a question or is it just a statement?
No, I was just, because I was throwing that into the pot here about where they're moving on these salary brackets, and when they're formalized into a structure and you can't give them any more and they're experienced, they're going to leave and go private sector. I do have something, though. I would like to mention that I think that was the last meeting where we were talking about Illinois having a $38 million budget with a similar size and so forth of to Minnesota. It turns out that following the rumors around the halls, I find that's an annual budget, where it's a $40 million biannual budget. So you have to be careful when you're comparing one state with another that we're looking at.
Thank you. Thank you. The final question goes to Representative Nash. Hopefully it's quick.
Mr. Chair, I will be quick. Mr. Hubinger, question for you. We saw that MnSure premiums went up dramatically, somewhere in the 40% range. Did the state absorb the lion's share of that, and did the employees only take on the 5% that I think you referenced?
Director.
Mr. Chen, Representative Nash, the MnSure employees are participate in the state employee group insurance program, so their premiums were determined through that plan, not the ones that are on their marketplace.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you. And Ness is the time. Taxes will be starting here in a few minutes, so this meeting is adjourned. Thank you, Director, for that informative brief. Thank you. This meeting is adjourned.